As a boy growing up in Czechoslovakia, Ivan Becker escaped the Holocaust. This hour, Becker recounts how his family fled Europe during the Second World War. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. On Wednesday evening, Becker will speak at the National Czech and Slovak Museum and Library in Cedar Rapids. It's free, but the museum is asking attendees to RSVP. This hour, I'll talk with Becker about the day he fled Prague under Nazi occupation. He'll also tell us about Nicholas Winton, the man who organized the Kinder transport trains that saved Becker and over 600 other children. Conversation with Ivan Becker. First, this news.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My guest today is Ivan Becker. Becker was born in Czechoslovakia, where he spent his boyhood. In May of 1939, as a 10-year-old Jewish boy, he fled the Nazi-occupied Czechoslovakia for the United Kingdom aboard one of the so-called Kinder transport trains organized by Nicholas Winton, a young London stockbroker. Winton is credited with organizing the rescue of 669 children, most of them Jewish, from Czechoslovakia. Ivan Becker captured his memories as one of the children who was saved by Winton, and how it shaped his later work as an activist in a book published in 2016 called My Train to Freedom, A Jewish Boy's Journey from Nazi Europe to a Life of Activism. Ivan Becker joins us today. Hi, Ivan.
Hi, Ben.
We want to mention that you will be speaking this week at the National Czech and Slovak Museum and Library on September 27th, Wednesday, at 7 p.m. in the evening. It's open to the public.
I'm really looking forward to being in Cedar Rapids and also visiting that museum and library, which I've heard a lot about.
Okay, very good. I mentioned Nicholas Winton, a huge figure for you and for so many others who were saved by his actions at the start of the Second World War. I want to talk about him a little bit later. Let's first focus on your experience. Set the scene for us and tell us what was happening in Czechoslovakia. You were a boy in Prague in the 1930s, the late 1930s.
Well, let me back up a little to 1938 and the Munich Pact, because that was really the beginning of my awareness of what's going on. As my parents listened to Hitler speaking, and with that guttural, threatening voice, I could see them literally shaking with fear because they knew that something terrible was going to happen. And, of course, it happened 6 months later in March of 1939 when his troops walked into the Czech Republic, or Czechoslovakia then, because at Munich, all the defenses of the Czechoslovak Republic were taken by Hitler, and our country was left really defenseless. So that's when my awareness of what was going on really started. And then in May of 1939, I was put on the train to then Great Britain, now the United Kingdom.
Tell us about that scene. You describe it in your book so vividly, because in hindsight, it's easy to say, well, everyone should have gotten out. But at that time, you describe how also Jewish families were divided in Prague about whether it was serious enough to leave, and also parents to send their children away, right?
Yeah, very much divided. In fact, our own family was divided on that issue. But my mother saw it very clearly, largely because she gave lessons to diplomats and other people in Prague, lessons in Czech, because before 1918 and the creation of the Republic, German was the official language, and many people who were leaders in Czechoslovakia were German speakers and had to learn Czech. So she had some insight, and that led her to a real determination that we all must get out. And by we, I mean my immediate family, father, herself, mother, and my older brother, Frank.
Tell us about the day that you were put on that Kinder transport train in May of 1939.
Well, it was late afternoon in May, and we went to the Masaryk station, which is not the main station, but there were about 60 of us kids on that particular transport. And I just remember the station was swarming with German troops. Some had dogs with them, and it was a very unfriendly atmosphere. And there we were hugging our relatives who had come to see us off, and some parents were crying, and the kids were trying to struggle out of embraces that were too tight. And some parents took their kids off and then put them back on. It was such a traumatic scene. And my mother was really stoic about it all. She knew that she was saving my life, and that was her guiding principles.
Mm-hmm. Was it clear on that train platform to the children and to all of the adults that were the adults perhaps telling their children goodbye forever? Did they know that?
I think some of them must have been aware of that because it happened to most of the children, because my family was really unusual because my father had already gone to London purportedly on business, but it was really an escape. And so I had already my father there, and that eased the apprehension for me. Others did not have that, and in fact found out after the war that their parents had perished.
Mm-hmm. In the death camps.
In the death camps, exactly.
You write in your book, let me quote just a couple lines here.
Sure.
As I reflect now on my Kinder transport journey and recall experiences that followed in England, I realize how vulnerable and often alone I was, and yet nothing seemed to frighten or faze me very long. So this was, for a 10-year-old, a more of an adventure. Do you remember being frightened?
I remember the train left Prague about 5 o'clock in the evening, and it journeyed north and through Germany all that night. And I remember having an uncomfortable feeling during that night that here I was in the very heart of my enemy, and there was nothing really to stop the German troops stopping the train, taking us off, and doing whatever they wanted. But in fact, nothing happened at the border. All our papers were in order, and so the Germans let us through. But when we arrived in Holland, which was about mid-morning the next day, there was a visible sign of relief on the part of all of us that we were out of the clutches of the Nazis.
And at this time, Holland was not occupied by the Nazis. That
no,
would come
exactly.
later.
No, exactly. It was occupied in 1940, a year later.
Mm-hmm. Tell us, your family, you escaped. Tell us about your family members, your father, Benno, your brother, Frank, your mother, Alice, had perhaps the most harrowing escape here. Perhaps you can tell us her story quickly.
It is a harrowing story. She was left in Prague, and it was August of 1939. Now, remember that war broke out on September 1st. At that time, you had to have a work permit from the British government to leave and go to England. And she had that work permit, but it expired at the end of August. So, and she still did not have it, although she had done all the required paperwork, you know, paying taxes and receipts and all of that. So on the 30th of August, she went to the Gestapo office where she had to get the final permit in her passport. And she bypassed the Czech Jewish committee that okayed, sort of gave prior approval. Because one of the diabolical things about the Nazis was that they made the Jews do all their dirty work. But she had a friend, and so she bypassed that obstacle and stood outside of the Gestapo office. Of course, you couldn't go in. That was strictly forbidden. But it came closing time, and she was still standing there, and the German officer who saw her and knew she was there said, "What do you want?" And she said, "I want my exit permit." And she sort of poured out her story of how she must get out. And he reached back, stamped her passport, threw it at her, and said, "Get out." But really, he saved her life. And so the next day she crossed the border on foot into Bavaria. And when the Germans at the border, she had a friend drive her there. When they saw that everything was okay in the passport, they even helped carry her suitcases. She had three heavy suitcases with her over the border. And there was a train that was going to Nuremberg. And so she got on there. And at Nuremberg, there was one of those massive Nazi congresses taking place. And she describes vividly the blood-long flags that were the Nazi symbol in the middle of it. And because it was the day before the invasion of Poland, there were no trains going west. So she negotiated with a taxi driver to take her by taxi to Cologne, which is, of course, in the western part of Germany, near the border with France. And she describes how in that beautiful autumn German sunny day, she felt like a tourist, but she didn't know what was going to happen to her. Mm-hmm. And then she could take a train to the a little north, and on the Belgian-German border, she was caught at a little station with just three people on the staff, a Nazi commandant, a nurse, and one soldier. And the nurse was called and strip-searched her, and he took the rest of the commandant, took the rest most of the money that she had hidden someplace, which was intended to be sent to her sister, who was in Berlin. She was an artist, and she was killed later during an Allied bomber attack. But the Nazi commandant that told her in no uncertain, "I can't be bothered with a dirty Jewess now," and he took the money, and so she could not, he could not blame my mother for anything, since he was the guilty party of stealing. So she was free to cross the border, and she asked the soldier, "So where is the border?" And he said, "You see that red light in the distance? That's the Belgian border." Mm-hmm. And so in the middle of the night, they had spilled all her belongings from the suitcases on the platform. And she said she repacked those three heavy suitcases and lugged them one by one that half a mile or so to the red light border. But she was safe. She had no money, but the Belgians were wonderful. They let her on the next train to Brussels, and in Brussels she had some friends who lent her money.
If you've just joined us, my guest is Ivan Bakker. His book, written in 2016, My Train to Freedom, A Jewish Boy's Journey from Nazi Europe to a Life of Activism, telling about his escape aboard one of the they're called Kinder Transport Trains, organized by Nicholas Winton, who was knighted. Sir Nicholas Winton rescued 669 children. Ivan is one of the children who was rescued by this courageous young London stockbroker. I wanted to have you continue with your story on to England, you and your family, after escaping Czechoslovakia, occupied by the Nazis at that time, and then on to the United States. There's so much here to cover, Ivan, but I wanted to concentrate for a moment on Sir Nicholas Winton and play a little piece that you mentioned in your book. This is from a 60 Minutes episode about Nicholas Winton from, I believe, 2014. It is an amazing piece of footage, if you can see the YouTube video of it. We'll play the audio. An excerpt where Winton actually kept this. He never talked about what he did in saving these 669 children for 50 years. The BBC discovered it, and he was then brought to a show with an audience. And, you can figure out what happened here. The audience was mainly filled, or largely filled, with children then grown up that he had saved. Let's listen to this excerpt from 60 Minutes.
In 1988, the BBC learned about Winton's story and invited him to be part of a program. He had no idea that the people sitting around him were people he had saved.
Can I ask, is there anyone in our audience tonight who owes their life to Nicholas Winton? If so, could you stand up, please? Mr. Winton, would you like to turn round? On behalf of all of them, thank you very much indeed.
I suppose it was the most emotional moment of my life, suddenly being confronted with all these children who weren't by any means children anymore.
Nicholas Winton being interviewed by 60 Minutes there at the age of, I believe, 104. Unfortunately, Ivan, you were one of the children saved, but you were not in that audience.
I was not. They couldn't find an address for me. But, you know, that excerpt you played still sends shivers down my spine. It was such a moving moment that it's indelible in my mind.
It's amazing, too, when you look at the video. He wipes a few tears away from his eyes when he looks back and sees these adults he had saved as children.
Exactly.
But he, it's so understated, I think that's why it makes it so moving. But also the fact that he kept quiet about it for 50 years, this incredible feat.
Yeah, I want to correct that impression a little bit, because he never denied it. He actually ran for a local office in the 1950s, this was 7 or 8 years after the war, and on his campaign literature, he listed that. So
okay.
It was never a secret, but, you know, over the years, he never mentioned it, and then his wife found this incredible little suitcase in the attic where he kept all the records of what had happened in saving us kinder transport kids.
Mm-hmm. Let's jump to England after escaping from Czechoslovakia through Germany, through the Netherlands, through Holland. You cross the English Channel, arrive in England. You are set up, the English had set you up with families. You were taken in, and this is how Winton had...
Actually, that was Nicholas Winton who had to find families to take us in. Mm-hmm. So he not only helped us get out of Czechoslovakia, he also had to make sure that there was a home, an English home for us. And that family had to put up £50, which in those days was quite a significant sum of money.
Right. You were reunited with your family, with your mother again, at an interesting estate, the Dunn estate that you describe here, Battle House, that you returned to later in life as well.
Yes, I visited it in 1985 and was amazed, because as a boy I looked at it as a great big manor house. It was two stories tall, and it was a very good structure. But as an adult, it seemed very much smaller. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing on that visit was that as I drove up the long driveway, there were Quonset huts on both sides of the road, and it was a nursery, and the nursery was run by a former Czech pilot in the during World War II. So yeah. We had a grand reunion there. Yeah.
Mm. And it's interesting, too, during your time in school in England, you were not out of the reach of the Nazis. You were in a school that was strafed by German pilots.
Yes. It was a public school, and one day, sort of out of the blue, they came, and the sirens did sound. But they machine gunned the school, and we scurried under our desks as we had been instructed. And there were no casualties, but still, it was a frightening experience.
Ivan Becker, we have to take a short break. We'll be back. This is such a fascinating conversation about your book and your life. We have still a lot of your life to talk about. We won't get to all of it, but we'll touch on some other parts. Ivan Becker, My Train to Freedom, A Jewish Boy's Journey from Nazi Europe to a Life of Activism. And we'll be back in just a moment. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My guest today, Ivan Becker, My Train to Freedom, his book, A Jewish Boy's Journey from Nazi Europe to a Life of Activism. Ivan Becker, will recount his stories, read passages from his book this Wednesday, September 27th, at the National Czech and Slovak Museum and Library. It's a free public talk that starts at 7 p.m., speaking today with Ivan from his home in Connecticut. Let's pick up the story a little bit of your time in England, and then you're crossing the Atlantic to the United States, to immigrate to the United States. I was interested in the account you have of a relationship you had as a schoolboy with an English cobbler who had fought during the First World War.
It was fascinating. I don't even remember how it started, but his little shop was right across from the school. And so I often stopped by to speak with him. And I was amazed by a couple of things. First of all, this ordinary workman knew exactly where each of his tools were. He was so organized that he could hold a conversation with me and never stop working. And we were both lamenting how so soon after that terrible World War from 1914 to 1918, how 20 years and 20 plus years, the same thing could be happening in Europe, and it was ravaged even more, of course, than in World War One.
Mm-hmm. You describe in your book your voyage to the United States in 1944. Now you are 15 years old, leaving England. You have some really wonderful descriptions of the Atlantic crossing. Bill, the medical orderly there who took care of you, Mrs. Basova, I think is the way you say her name, in your cabin there, who was quite something. And you were part crossing the Atlantic in a convoy of about 70 or 80 ships in 1944 because you're being protected by military destroyers, protected from German U-boats, right?
Exactly, yeah. And we managed to escape the U-boats by sailing south first into the Gulf Stream, which was beautiful. It was October and it was warm. And then we sort of zigzagged north to land in Canada. And as we went north, the U-boats did catch us. And we heard depth charges being deployed by the armed forces to hunt down those U-boats. And luckily, there were no ships sunk in that crossing.
Mm-hmm. It was interesting, too, aboard that boat, that ship crossing the Atlantic, it was the SS Beaverhill, that you experienced, found out the election results, the U.S. election results of 1944.
That's right. There was a lot of discussion about it, and of course everybody was rooting for Roosevelt because my father was so worried that if he did not get reelected, the war would not be pursued and won, and so it was a great sense of relief when the results were announced and Roosevelt had indeed won a fourth term.
You went to high school in New York City, George Washington High School. That was an interesting experience because it was huge, 5,000 students compared to a small Czech school, and you had your first experience with children who had different skin color.
Absolutely, yes. There were, in England, I just saw one black man once in London in a public park. And here, I don't remember how many black, both boys and girls there were, but it was certainly a very mixed population.
Mm-hmm.
And the very first day, that I was sort of wandering around not knowing where I was supposed to be. A big African-American guy put his arm around my shoulder and said, "Where do you want to go?" And he pointed me in the right direction. But, you know, that gesture just emptied any fear I might have had. Not that I was consciously afraid of anybody, but it was just so welcome that, well, I've had a lot of respect, and I've worked for anti-discrimination and segregation, largely because of that experience, I think.
Let's talk a little bit about that, because in your writing, your book, you say that your intent was to investigate the central question that hangs over your post-war life. The question, how do you pose it to yourself today in describing what you did with the rest of your life?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, the question was, why was I saved? Why was I spared the experience of so many of my kids' contemporaries who just didn't survive the war and perished in the concentration camps? And my answer was, you got to do something for other people. And that's where my activism comes in, because I think I've tried to the best of my ability to do things that were useful to the society and for other people, especially in terms of both peace and justice.
You went to, as a young man, you went to Moravian College in Pennsylvania. You describe how you wanted to go to medical school. You also wanted to be, you saw it as a way to get to be a missionary. You went to theological seminary to be, you were a priest in a parish in the 1960s, during the time of great upheaval in this country, during the civil rights movement, also the upheaval surrounding Vietnam. What do you recall as your most formative experiences at that time in the 1960s as a parish priest?
That's difficult to say. I think the consuming issue then was the Vietnam War, which is so vividly described currently by Ken Burns in the documentary that's being shown. But the demonstrations in Washington, and especially the 1963 march, when so many of us came from different parts of the country to protest the war, and then Martin Luther King's speech, at memorable speech at that great gathering in front of the Lincoln Memorial. That was an unforgettable moment.
Were you there to see that speech?
I was, yes.
Mm-hmm. What do you remember most about it?
How it built. It begins sort of laying out the groundwork, and then when he talks about his children and how he was ashamed of what was going on. And then later, when in his sermon at Riverside Church in New York, when he linked the fight for civil rights to the war in Vietnam, it was an obvious connection, but he articulated it so well, and it was extremely influential.
Mm-hmm. Also, during this time of the Vietnam period in the 1960s, as a priest, tell us the story of being asked by two Marines to accompany them to a home to inform parents that their son had been killed.
Yes, that was a such a vivid moment. First of all, you know, I'm at home and I see these two Marines knocking on my door, wondering what was going on. And it was the custom then of the armed forces to have a local clergyman accompany them to notify the parents that their son had been killed. I'm using son because there were no females in that active war. And we knocked on this couple's door. They were fairly poor people. They rented an upstairs apartment above a store on the main street of East Rutherford, New Jersey. And of course, they knew what the news was as soon as they saw the officers. And the thing that struck me, we were all speechless. The officers made their official pronouncement. I couldn't say anything. I was just so overcome with their grief, and then linked it to the larger question. The war was so useless and destructive that their son, I felt, had died for nothing. And so I remember how useless I thought I was on that visit and how little I could do for that bereaved family.
Mm-hmm. Did that change the course of your life as a priest?
No, it just reinforced my determination to work for the end of that terrible war.
If you've just joined us, I'm talking with Ivan Becker, My Train to Freedom, the title of his book from 2016, A Jewish Boy's Journey from Nazi Europe to a Life of Activism. He was one of 669 children, most of them Jewish, from Czechoslovakia, who were saved by an Englishman, now a knight. He died a couple of years ago, Nicholas Winton. This is a memoir of how Ivan and his family escaped from Czechoslovakia, came to first to England, then to the United States, and how really the experience of avoiding the horrors of the Holocaust have shaped his identity and his work as a humanitarian and as an activist. Ivan, one of your chapters in the book is titled, Am I a Jew? Am I a Christian? How do you think of yourself now and your religious identity?
I think of myself as both. And let me tell you how it happened. In England, after I attended that Czech school which you described, I was sent to an English boarding school which was run by the Moravian Church, which is a small sect, a Protestant denomination, which actually started in what later became Czechoslovakia. And there I found a community that was loving and supportive and accepting, and it was really my best experience in England. And I was so happy there that I wanted to become a part of it. And so that's when I was baptized to become a Christian. And later a priest in the Episcopal Church. But I was always conscious and knowing and certainly not denying my Jewish heritage. I didn't publicize it very much so that some people, I think, even today, are surprised to know my background as a Christian. But in my view, there's so little contradiction. There's certainly the same values, the same scriptures, the Old Testament that we have in common. So I didn't see any conflict and never have.
It occurs to me in reading your book that, Ivan, you have lived through tumultuous decades, through the 30s in Czechoslovakia, on into the 40s through the Second World War, but also in writing in this book about living through the civil rights movement in this country, the challenges that had, the challenges of the Vietnam War and the protests against it. And now you live in Connecticut, and we are experiencing quite a bit of divisive political times now. I wondered, what are your thoughts with your long view stretching back to the middle of the 20th century, your thoughts about our current political times here?
Well, in my view, they're certainly not encouraging, and I really fear for the country. It has bent to the right. Racism, which was never extinct, but at least was more dormant than it is now, is so much forward and so supported by our present that I shudder to think of what the future will hold. I just hope that we can turn from the present direction and return to some of the values that I so much cherished as an American. And then on the world scene, I just see more of the mistakes happening, especially, watching that the Vietnam War series now, where we went in there with so many troops and were trying to convince the North Vietnamese, but by killing them, we created more partisans. We created their army. We reinforced their determination to be independent. And I see Afghanistan, the same things going on in Iraq. It's just very discouraging.
Mm-hmm. Do you see the divisions in our country currently, the hyper-partisanship, differently, do you think, because of your background and what you've experienced?
I don't know. I think it must be a part of my DNA. I certainly deplore it more, but I don't know. I can't relate it to my experience as a escapee from the Holocaust.
Mm-hmm. May I ask, how old are you now, Ivan?
I'm 88.
88. And what do you do with your days? Your political activism continues, I imagine.
Well, it isn't as active as it used to be, but I think that's understandable. But I still write opinion pieces for my local paper, letters to the editor, and be in touch with my legislators, and support causes which kind of carry on my ideals, mainly through the Quaker organization, the FCNL, which means Friends Committee on National Legislation, especially carries forward my convictions and my point of view, and I support that strongly.
Well, thank you for spending the hour with us, Ivan Becker, author of My Train to Freedom, A Jewish Boy's Journey from Nazi Europe to a Life of Activism. You will be coming to Iowa on Wednesday to speak at the National Czech and Slovak Museum and Library. It's 7 p.m. Wednesday evening, and it's open to the public. So you have a chance to meet Ivan then.
But I understand that they want you to register if you're coming, because they have had a very positive response to my coming.
That is not surprising. Ivan, I want to thank you for spending time with us. It's been such a pleasure to enjoy your book, to read it, and to talk with you about some of these experiences. So much we didn't get to. It's a wonderful book.
It's been a pleasure talking to you, Ben. Thank you very much.
And Ivan, to close, I don't know if you wanted to comment on this. We thought it would be a treat, because you do mention this in the book, to go out with a little bit of Czech music that you mentioned that reminds you of your homeland that you left when you were 10 years old, The Moldau by the Czech composer Bedřich Smetana.
Wonderful.
Can you just tell us, Ivan, what you think of when you hear this music by Smetana?
Well, I want to tell you about an incident in London when my parents took me to a gathering of adults, and they listened to Smetana's Vltava, now in English called the Moldau, and people were crying. I couldn't understand it, but it makes us think so much of our homeland, and people who were living in London at the time, Czechs, were so moved emotionally that I never forget that.
All right. Take care, Ivan.
Thank you, Ben. Goodbye.
Goodbye now. The Moldau by the Czech composer Bedřich Smetana to end this edition of River to River. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Ben Stanton, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.